Hi, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. Big E here. This is Law for Virginia Law Enforcement Officers, and it's episode 86. Today, we're talking about a new case from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals reversing a district court decision in the case called Franklin versus Charlotte from South Carolina. And it's a case where the district court had dismissed a lawsuit against police and the city of Charlotte after the officers shot and killed a man outside of a restaurant parking lot. It's a really interesting case. It is a case that you actually can go online and watch the video of yourself. You just need to Google his name, which is Dakir Franklin, and you can find this video, which is a body camera video. And his name is spelled Danquiris, Franklin. And, you know, it's obviously a disturbing video. It's obviously a video of a shooting, and Mr. Franklin dies. And so, you know, watch it with caution. But if you're a law enforcement officer, it's certainly educational. And this case itself, I think, is a fascinating case for a lot of reasons. So let's talk about what the facts are. Let's talk about what the court ruled here. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the other cases that the court references and how the law on this matter might be sort of changing or evolving, or more to the point, I think more the way the court views these situations might be changing and evolving. So this case takes place in 2019 outside of a Burger King restaurant in Charlotte, North Carolina. And individuals call 911 reporting that Mr. Franklin, the plaintiff in this case, was threatening patrons and staff with a firearm. So it's obviously a dangerous call. Two officers respond to the call. And as they're responding, and the officers don't know this, the plaintiff had stepped outside of the restaurant, had crouched down next to the passenger side of a car where he and somebody were talking. The passenger inside the car where he was crouching down was apparently trying to calm him down. When the officers arrive, they get out of the car, they don't have a clear view of him, but they immediately draw their firearms and order him, "Let me see your hands, let me see your hands now," give him about four commands, and they move themselves into a position where they can look at the plaintiff. Now, when they're looking at him, he's still crouched down by this car, and they're looking at his left side. His hands are between his legs, and he's sort of squatting down on the ground, kind of like a catcher in a baseball game, but you're only seeing his side, and you can't see his hands. So the lead officer gets out in front so that she can at least see the plaintiff crouching down on the ground. And again, can't see his hands, can only see his left shoulder and his left side. He's on the balls of his feet, again, in that catcher's position. And she begins ordering him, "Drop the gun, drop the gun." And the officers back and forth just start screaming various versions of "drop it, drop the gun, drop the weapon." I said, "Drop it, put it on the ground, put it on the ground, drop it." Now, they don't hear him say this, but one time you can, on the body camera, kind of hear him say, "I heard you the first time." But he's sort of this pausing there, motionless, sort of as if he's either disassociated completely from the moment or lost in thought, or, as is maybe the case, struggling with thinking about how to deal with this situation. The officers don't know this, but the plaintiff does have a firearm. It is, however, he doesn't have it in his hands. He has it tucked inside of his jacket. So in order to drop the gun as he's ordered, he's going to have to first reach inside his jacket and pull out the gun. So this goes on about 20 more times, 20 more commands or so, "Drop the gun, drop it, drop the weapon," and so on. He's totally passive. He's fixed, kind of, his eyes are kind of looking either at the ground or looking forward. And then finally, he reaches into the right side of his jacket and pulls out a handgun with his right hand. And he has it sort of, he's grabbing the slide. He's grabbing the side of the grip with the muzzle pointed away from the officers. But at that point, seeing the gun, or apparently seeing the gun, the officers begin to fire, and he is struck twice, and he falls. As he's sort of dropping away, he actually says the phrase, "You told me to." So the plaintiff died within about an hour, and there's an investigation. The investigation is important because ultimately it plays a role in the lawsuit later. The city reviews it. They have a review board that reviews use of force, and they find here that the shooting was a lawful shooting, and the police department's review board finds that it's a lawful shooting, and the city agrees with that finding and sustains the finding that it was a lawful shooting. So the plaintiff sues the officers, obviously, for an unlawful use of force. And in addition to that, they sue the city for two reasons. One, on the grounds that the city unlawfully found that it was a lawful use of force. And two, for negligent training of the officer. And the trial court grants a motion to dismiss all of the claims against both the officer and the city. And so in that way, the case arrives on the Fourth Circuit. And the Fourth Circuit has to decide this case. Now, it's an interesting panel in this case. I want to talk about the panel for a moment. We have three judges hearing this case. Judge Gregory, who's the chief judge, and he's going to write the opinion in this case. Now, Judge Gregory, we've talked about him before. He's written a lot of opinions that are not necessarily friendly towards law enforcement, and he's often highly critical of law enforcement. He's the author of the Curry case that we've talked about many times in this podcast before, which was the active shooter case where he severely criticized the officers for ordering Mr. Curry when the officers run up on an active shooting incident to show his waistband, lift his shirt, and indicated officers shouldn't have the discretion to be able to do that to stop people who are in an active shooting situation to see if they're armed. But then we also have Judge Wilkinson. Now, Judge Wilkinson was one of the dissenters in the Curry case, and he's somebody who often is much more friendly towards law enforcement. He often is critical of attempts, for example, to roll back qualified immunity, and has been critical of those efforts in the past. Judge Wilkinson's going to end up concurring in this case. He's going to end up agreeing with Judge Gregory that the motion to dismiss was wrongfully granted, and this case should be going to trial. And so it'll be interesting to talk about Judge Wilkinson's concurrence in a minute. And then lastly, the last member of this panel is Judge Gibney. And Judge Gibney is not actually a Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals judge. He's a district judge. He's from the Eastern District of Virginia. He often hears cases in Richmond. He's a very experienced judge. He does a lot of cases involving police use of force and government liability and qualified immunity and 1983 lawsuits and so on. So Judge Gibney is a very respected judge. He is not, though, somebody who's on the Fourth Circuit. He's sitting by designation, which is something that often happens for senior judges when they've reached the end of their career. They can sit by designation. So here's the panel, and Judge Gregory begins by explaining here that when an officer issues a clear command to an armed suspect to do one thing, and that person does another, we seldom question the officer's use of force. We, the Fourth Circuit, seldom question the officer's use of force. But he continues, when the officer's abstruse commands, confusing commands, require the suspect to divine their meaning, the law cannot be so forgiving. In those circumstances, courts are duty-bound to engage in a searching examination of an officer's resort to deadly violence, and today we deal with such a case. So the court looks in detail at the facts of this case and what the officer's reaction to and commands were to the plaintiff in deciding, ultimately, that these officers were not protected by qualified immunity and this case should go to trial. The court agrees here with the plaintiff that a jury in this case, a reasonable jury, could find that these officers violated the Fourth Amendment by unlawfully shooting the plaintiff in this case. And in doing so, the court relies or sort of examines three previous sort of classic cases of officer use of force in the Fourth Circuit. And I think it's worth looking at each of those cases. So let's look at the cases that the court finds a sort of instructive in this case. And the first case I want to talk about is sort of the oldest case. And it's a case called Slattery versus Rizzo. A lot of you probably know about Slattery versus Rizzo. In fact, I think when I've taught before, some of you actually knew Officer Rizzo, who's the officer in this case who does the shooting. This is a case from Fourth Circuit decided in 1991. And it was a shooting that happened in 1990. And in this case, it was a narcotics buy bust operation that was happening in Fairfax County, Virginia. The officers were at a place called the Bull Run Grill, which was in Centerville, and it was an open air drug market. There had been lots of weapons, lots of violent incidents there. The narcotics unit had conducted law enforcement operations there before. They had recovered guns. Just before this event took place, they had recovered guns twice from two different individuals. They had actually planned an operation prior to this, but it had to be canceled because there was a drive-by shooting at the location several minutes before they began their operation. So finally, they're able to do this operation, this buy-bust operation. And here, the officer is sitting in a vehicle. His job is basically just watch the area, sit in his van, watch the area. He's wearing a vest with the word police on it. It's clear that he's a police officer. It says he's wearing a badge, and so on. They make a number of arrests that night. And in each one of the situations, somebody walks up to this officer, and then the team rushes in and arrests him. Here, when the arrest signal is given for the plaintiff in this case, many officers come out of hiding. They move in to arrest the drivers of this car. And the officer drives up to block the car with the plaintiff in it. He gets out of the van. He walks up to the driver of this car. And the driver, one of the suspects in this buy-bust operation, is sitting in the car. He shines his flashlight through the window. He can't see the plaintiff's hands. The officer says, "Police, police, put up your hands, put up your hands." He doesn't respond. At that point, the officer kicks the car window, and slowly the driver of the car, the plaintiff, turns and looks at the officer. Again, here the officer opens the door and yells, "Police, get up your hands, raise your hands, raise your hands." He's got his gun out. He cannot see the driver's left hand clearly. That's the hand that's away from the officer. So the door that he's got open is the passenger side door, I think, in this case. So he can't see it, but he can see that whatever the guy's doing with his hand, he's got it closed around some object. And again, the driver of the car has looked towards the officer. Now he starts turning away from the officer. The officer again says, "Put up your hands, put up your hands." And at that point, the guy blazes his body completely away from the officer, who now can't see his hands. And at that point, the officer, he says, it appears like the guy is coming at him with a weapon because he turns his whole body back towards the officer with something clasped in his left hand that he can't see. But he can see that something's clasped his left hand, and he's turning towards the officer. At that point, before he can see what's in the guy's hand, the officer shoots and kills the plaintiff in this case. The object in the plaintiff's hand turns out to be a beer bottle. And so in this case, he brings a lawsuit against the officer. And actually, I'm trying to remember now. I think I might have this wrong. I think the plaintiff may not have been killed. I think he survives in this case. I think he's shot, but he is not killed. Now I can't remember. But all right, anyway, so he brings a lawsuit against the officer, and the Fourth Circuit here looks at the facts and rules very simply, we believe under the undisputed facts of the case, a reasonable officer could have probable cause to believe that the appellee posed a deadly threat, and therefore the officer would be authorized to use deadly force. So in that case, the officer was entitled to qualified immunity. They reverse the order of the district court, and they remand the case for dismissal. And there's not a lot of analysis. The case is pretty short. It's about, you know, it's about 4 pages long. They talk about the facts. They talk about the ruling in Tennessee versus Garner, which at that point was only about 5 years old and had just been handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. And then they make their conclusion. The district court in this case had wanted the case to go forward. The district court thought that the officer did not properly use force. The district court's opinion was only one page and basically said, "I deny it. In this case, you go to trial." So it's kind of interesting here that the case goes into such little detail because it ends up being a very influential case for the next 25 years. So the next case that the court here in the Charlotte case talks about in detail and sort of makes a comparison to is a 2017 case. And this case is a case called Hensley versus Price. Now, Hensley versus Price is a case out of North Carolina. And in this case, officers respond to a domestic disturbance. It's not clear what the nature of the disturbance is, but when they arrive, they are in their cars and they see the plaintiff in this case, who ends up being shot and killed, Hensley, and his two daughters. They walk out of the porch, and when they do, Hensley struggles with his older daughter and strikes her with a handgun. He's got a handgun in his hand, and he strikes her with the handgun. At that point, the fight appears to be over. He hits her, and then he just sort of walks off. And he walks off the porch towards the officers. When he reaches the yard, he then looks back at his daughters on the porch. At that point, he's got the handgun in his hand. Now, this case ends up being dismissed by the trial court on qualified immunity grounds. The case ends up not being dismissed on qualified immunity grounds. The district court refuses to dismiss the case on qualified immunity grounds. And so the officers appeal. So because they appeal, and because they're appealing a pretrial motion, in this case, the Fourth Circuit has to treat the facts in the manner most favorable to the plaintiff, to the fellow who was shot and killed. So the deputies are going to give a different version of events, but here we have to assume that the plaintiffs are telling the truth because of the procedural posture of the case. Ultimately, at trial, it might be decided otherwise. Here, the deputies will say that Mr. Hensley then turned towards them and had the gun at his hip pointed at the deputies. But that's not what we can assume at this point. We have to assume that what the plaintiffs are saying is true. So what the plaintiffs say is that the handgun was still pointed at the ground, the muzzle was still pointed at the ground, and he continues to walk down the stairs towards the deputies. At that point, the deputies don't say anything to the plaintiff. The plaintiff doesn't say anything to them. He's just walking towards the officers with the gun pointed at the ground. At that point, the deputies step out of their car and just shoot him and kill him. That's the plaintiff's version of what happens. And again, that's not what the deputies say. The deputies say something different. They say he had the gun pointed towards them, but again, we're not going to go down that road because of the procedural posture. So the court looks at that and they say, well, under those facts as provided by the plaintiff, there's no serious threat of physical harm to the deputies or his daughters at that point. He's got a gun, but the mere possession of a gun without more does not justify the use of deadly force. And in the Hensley case, they also talk about a case called Cooper versus Sheehan, which was another response to a domestic disturbance. And that was a case where officers walked up to a window, tapped on the window with a flashlight, and Mr. Cooper looked out the door and said, "Hey, is anybody out there? Who is out there? I can't hear you." He grabs a shotgun to see who's outside the house, and he's got the butt of the firearm in his hand and the muzzle towards the ground. He opens the back door, steps out into the porch, and the officers... Cooper can't see them, but he comes up on the officers, and at that point they draw their gun and they just shoot him. And in that case, the court said that use of deadly force violated the Fourth Amendment because he never raised the shotgun towards the officers. Again, he had a shotgun, but it's his house. And here the court said an officer does not possess the unfettered authority to shoot a member of the public simply because that person's carrying a weapon. And again, this is the plaintiff's version, right? So the officers obviously say something different, but that's what the court's ruling on at this point. So again, the officers get there. It's just early in the morning. They walk out onto the porch. He's got a handgun, but he never raises it towards the deputies. He does strike the daughter with the handgun, but then the fight appears to be over. And then he steps off the porch into the yard. He's got the handgun pointed at the ground. So when the deputies fire on him, the conflict is over. He's off the porch, away from the person he's attacked. And so the court said, even if the officers could reasonably have believed that he posed a threat of serious physical harm, they also failed to warn him. And, you know, Tennessee versus Garner is clear that if it's feasible, officers should give a warning, right? If it's feasible, and sometimes it's not feasible at all. But here, the failure to warn the plaintiff weighed against the officers because in the moments leading up to the fatal shooting, they saw him walk down the steps. They saw him pause and stop and look back at the house. They watched as he walked towards them. While all of that played out, the officers never give any commands whatsoever. They never say, "Drop the gun." They never say, "We're going to shoot," and so on. And the court clarifies here and makes very clear, if an officer directs somebody to stop, say, show your hands, that person's continued movement usually will raise in the officer's mind an objectively grave and serious suspicion about the suspect's intentions. And even when those intentions turn out to be harmless, as they did in Slattery versus Rizzo, for example, where he had the beer bottle in his hand, the officer can reasonably expect the worst at the split second when he acts. In this case, though, because they gave no command to stop, drop the gun, or raise his hands, because they gave no warning at all, they had no reason to suspect he posed an immediate threat other than that he was holding the gun, than he was holding a gun that was pointed at the ground. In this case, then, they affirm the refusal to grant qualified immunity. Judge Shedd, who was here a circuit judge sitting by designation, just made very much like Judge Gibney was, dissented in this case. And he argued here that the officers were confronted by an armed person who just committed a violent crime and was walking towards them. Those officers were permitted to believe they were under an imminent threat. But here he dissents. So that case ends up heading towards trial, and that's Judge Agee and Judge Duncan. The other case the court looks at in the case from South Carolina that we talked about is a case called Anderson versus Russell. And this is a case from Maryland where an officer was working off part-time security at a Prince George's County mall. A mall patron walked up to him and said, "There's a guy who appears to have a gun under his sweater," and he points to the plaintiff. The officer watches the guy for about 20 minutes and sees a bulge under his clothing that he believes is consistent with a handgun. He walks up to him, and he walks up with his guns drawn. He gets another officer, and the other officer draws his gun as well. And he says, "Put up your hands, get down on your knees." The plaintiff in this case puts up his hands, but then for reasons that are just not clear at all, he then lowers his hands to reach into his back left pocket. His intention apparently had been to turn off his Walkman. He had a Walkman on, and he wanted to reach down and turn his Walkman off. But at that point, he's reaching down towards a bulge, which the officer had believed, based on what the patron had told him, was a handgun. He ends up shooting the plaintiff three times, causing permanent injuries. The plaintiff survives, but all the plaintiff had on his person was a radio. So here the court said, well, in this situation, the officer reasonably believed that the gentleman, the plaintiff, had a gun. The armed citizen had reported that he had a bulge. He reported that he had a handgun. Ultimately, that bulge turns out to be an eyeglass case stuffed with shoe polish, but it was consistent with the shape of a gun. And the court said, well, then in that case, the officer is justified in believing, based on the totality of circumstances, that it is a gun. And it's interesting that he's ordering him to put up his hands, and instead of that, he's lowering his hands to reach down in disregard of the officer's order. And remember what the other case had said: when somebody is reaching in violation of an order not to do so, it's reasonable for an officer to believe that the guy's reaching towards a gun. Here the court writes, any reasonable officer in the officer's position would have immediately feared for his safety and the safety of others. And they repeat here that many cases had held an officer does not have to wait until a gun is pointed at him before he's permitted to take action. They talk about lots of different cases, including the Slattery versus Rizzo case from Fairfax, and a case called McLennigan, where they wrote, "We don't think it's wise to require a police officer in all instances to actually detect the possession of a weapon," or a case called Sigmund, where the court wrote, "Notwithstanding the possibility of a dispute about whether a knife was actually in his hand, Officer Riddle acted on the perception that he had a knife in his hand." So here the court finds that the officer did lawfully use deadly force because he reasonably believed that the plaintiff in this case posed a deadly threat to himself and others. It was mistaken, but it was lawful. And so here the court said it was proper to dismiss the case at summary judgment without a trial in favor of the officer, as the district court had done in this case. And this opinion, by the way, is notably written by Judge Wilkinson, who's going to end up concurring with Judge Gregory in refusing to dismiss the case from South Carolina. So this same Judge Wilkinson, right, agrees that the case that we've been talking about today should continue. So the court looks at those cases that we've talked about and considers, are they similar or are they different? with the gentleman outside of the Burger King who's crouching on the ground, and the officers are ordering him to drop his gun, but his gun is in his jacket. So here the court says, yeah, they got 911 reports that the guy is armed. And that's very similar to that Anderson case, right? Somebody has said this guy's got a gun. And the call is for somebody who's terrorizing people at a fast food restaurant with a gun. So that's pretty violent. But also when they get there, he's not inside the restaurant. He's crouching down and doesn't appear to be doing anything. Now the court looks at the warnings. And remember, warnings are really important, right? We talked about the Hensley case where the officers gave no warning. And we talked about the Slattery case where the officer gives very clear warnings. Here, the officers give 22 orders to the plaintiff to drop the weapon. But for the court, it's important that the only way to obey the command to drop the weapon is for the plaintiff to reach into his jacket and take it out. And here, the plaintiff is facing towards the car door, and he follows the command he's given. He holds the gun in a non-firing grip, points it away from everybody when he reaches in, and that's what results in his getting shot. So the court says, yeah, if you go back and you look at Slattery versus Rizzo, if the plaintiff had defied clear commands, then his actions may have provoked deadly force. And Judge Wilkinson had also been the judge in a case called Elliott versus Levitt. And this is a case from 1996, an old case from many years ago, where officers had arrested somebody for DUI and I guess hadn't sufficiently searched him, but he had a small handgun in his possession. When the officers go back, they arrest him for the DUI, they put him in handcuffs, they put him in the backseat of a car, and then when they go back to the car, they suddenly realize that he has removed a handgun. He's got it behind his back where his hands are handcuffed. He's released the seat belt. He's got his arms around and he's got the gun in his hand with the finger on the trigger. The officers scream out, "Gun!" Order him to drop the gun. He doesn't respond, and so they fire. And the court says, again, you know, this is a situation where they're giving him commands. He's not dropping the gun. They're in danger. He's, you know, inside the car. And so they're outside, but that doesn't alleviate the danger to the officers. But in this case, right, in the South Carolina case, the Burger King case, the court says the officer's commands were too ambiguous to turn that hesitation, the refusal to comply, his inability to comply to a refusal to comply. And here, right, they're saying, show me your hands, show me your hands, drop the gun. The court says those are inconsistent instructions. I can either show you my hands or I can drop the gun, but I can't do both. The court criticizes the officer for assuming that the gun is in his hands and says it's foreseeable here that if you command somebody to drop the gun that they don't have in their hands, they're going to reach for the gun and pull it out. And the way that he removes the gun, the court finds, is not threatening or not, especially in context. The court also thinks it's important, I think, that these officers, in the court's view, essentially increase the intensity of the situation or make the situation more tense by virtue of their, screaming orders, pulling out the gun. When they get there, he's not in any way, aggressive or out of control or threatening or holding the gun or anything like that. He's again crouching and just talking to somebody who's inside the car. They get this call that he's been threatening people. When they get there, there's no evidence of that when they arrive on the scene. The court does agree in this case that the city is not liable, that a post facto, after the event is over, approving and finding that a shooting is lawful does not open a city up to liability. So they agree that the city is not liable in this case. And in addition, the court agrees that the trial court properly dismissed the claim for negligent training here because there was nothing that the plaintiff was able to point to that showed some inherent unfitness or previous acts of negligence that showed some failure to train on the part of the city. But the court does believe that matter should go to trial. The court here writes, the officers in this case rushed headlong onto a scene that had subsided, established no dialogue, and shouted at Franklin loudly enough that they did not hear him communicate back. In their zeal to disarm him, it hardly occurred to the officers that their commands defied reality. As a result, Franklin faced a catch-22, obey and risk death, or disobey and risk death. And these facts entitle a jury of community members to decide whether the officer shot him unlawfully. The district court's decisions, therefore, were reversed, and the matter was set back for trial. And again, I think it's interesting that Judge Wilkinson concurs in this case. He points to the substantial evidence of the plaintiff's passive demeanor, which could lead a jury to conclude that his shooting was objectively disproportionate to the threat that he posed. Judge Wilkinson basically concurs just to say, look, and he writes this, qualified immunity recognizes the indispensable nature of effective police work in preserving the order that removes the regimes of predation that would otherwise plague a community. While I support the denial of qualified immunity in the particular circumstance of this very close case, the demise of this important doctrine would be an incalculable social loss, one which the varied stakeholders in this wonderfully diverse country would come to regret. So we have a really interesting set of facts, a challenging set of facts, a tragic result, and I think an interesting decision by the court. And it's interesting to see how much detail we have the court going into analysis versus the Slatter versus Rizzo case from so many years ago. I hope today was interesting. I hope you found the case from today interesting and useful in your thoughts about use of force in the future. If you like the podcast, tell your friends. If you don't like the podcast, don't tell your friends. We are on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Stitcher Podcasts. And it's been great to see everybody this month at some different trainings. Until next time, stay safe and don't get captured.